Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network for this Monday, the 15th of July. Oliver Sacks turned 80 last week, and he wrote about the joy of old age, no kidding, in the New York Times on July 6. We thought his reflections were more than worthy of our discussion, and we're delighted that he is our guest this hour. He's a professor of neurology at the NYU School of Medicine. He is the author of 12 books, most recently Hallucinations, and also, just to name a few of the other books, The Man Who Mistook His Wife for a Hat, Awakenings, Musicophilia, and The Mind's Eye. We'll be welcoming phone calls for Oliver Sacks. Our phone number, as always, is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@wpr.org, and our Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show. Dr. Oliver Sacks, hello. Thank you so much for being with us.
It's nice to speak with you again.
Yeah, great to have you here. Happy birthday.
Thank you.
Did you have a party?
Oh, I had a huge party.
You did? What happened?
Oh, well, there were just a great many people and a big cake and a lot of candles.
Oh. You say, and we think this when we turn 50 sometimes or 60, that you can hardly believe it. You often feel like life is about to begin and you have to realize that it's almost over. And that's a pretty sobering thought, isn't it?
It's one which one has to face all the while, and but I don't think it alters the joy of living.
Mm-hmm. You have this perspective, and I'm wondering if this carries throughout your life, that you were always the youngest boy at school, you write. You were the youngest of four sons. Your mother was 16th of 18 children. Holy Toledo. And now you're almost the oldest person you know.
I'm practically the oldest in the cousinhood. I exaggerated there. I do, in fact, have a good friend of 98 who tells me I'm just a kid.
And you want to hear that every day, I'll bet.
Yeah.
Tell me I'm just a kid. Does it change your perspective? You had a pretty near-death experience. You write about when you were 41 years old, when you thought you would die. Do you in some way think of all these extra years as extra?
It's a sort of a bonus. I certainly thought I wouldn't make it when I broke a leg on the mountain and I was alone, and the chances were very much against making it, and it was an absolute freak that I was spotted by a hunter, his son. But I think at this stage I regard every day and year as a bonus, mm-hmm. something I want to live fully.
Mm-hmm. You also, and we'll get into more of this, because it, close to your birthday, your book Hallucinations was also published in paperback, but you write about getting almost an auditory hallucination, didn't you? Somebody telling you to keep going.
That happened on the mountain. I managed to splint my leg after fashion and sort of was making my way down clumsily with my arms, and at one point, I was exhausted, and I thought it'd be nice to have a little rest, a little sleep. And quite a loud voice said, "No, you got to go on. Find a pace you can keep." I think sometimes I think hallucinations, whether they take the form of voices or anything else, can tell one what to do in a good way.
Mm. Well, it's good you listened to that one, isn't it? Or we wouldn't be speaking today. Think of all that you did that wouldn't have been done.
Yeah.
Yeah. You talk about a few of your regrets, one of which I find hard to believe, considering what a prolific writer you are and how many patients you have seen. You say that you are sorry that you've wasted so much time. Have you really?
I feel so. They're often hours and days in which I don't do anything much. When I do work, it's usually at a furious pace, and I may go nonstop for 24 hours. But I probably need to accept that this is just the way I am. There's rushing and stopping, and not a steady pace. But I feel I should go to more museums and more theaters and more concerts, and that I should walk more and travel more. and do everything more. Although I'm also glad for what I have done.
Mm-hmm. As well you should be. You also write about the fact that you are agonizingly shy. I wouldn't imagine you to be that way. You're as shy at 80 as you were at 20.
Well, I take after my mother very much in this way. She was shy at parties and things, and in general talking to people. On the other hand, she was when she talked in public or gave a lecture, she was a real ham, and so am I.
So privately at parties, at your 80th birthday party, you were shy?
Well, not at my birthday party, but at other parties, I tend to lurk in a corner.
Huh. And I'm sure you're the person in the room that 90% of the people want to speak to.
Well, they may. I don't know. Perhaps I have a forbidding look about me. But they usually don't come up to me.
Your mother, I just wanted to hear you talk about this a little bit, Dr. Sachs, because I find this astounding. Your mother being the 16th of 18 children, isn't that phenomenal?
Yeah. Well, my grandfather, her father, married twice. He had 5 children with his first wife and 13 with his second. But all 18 were close to one another. And now the cousin to whom I'm closest is a grandson of the firstborn, whereas I'm a son of the 16th born. But but the cousinhood was a wonderful thing, and it still is.
Mm-hmm. I would imagine. I had a friend. He was a dear man to the city. Frank Zeidler, his name. He was the mayor of Milwaukee for a number of years, and he was quite a reader and was in libraries all the time researching everything. I remember interviewing him on his 80th birthday and then again at his 90th birthday, but on his 80th birthday he had all these books with him, and I said, Mr. Zeidler, why are you carrying all those books? And he said, well, I've just turned 80 and I'm doing research on what happens to the body during the decade that I'm about to experience. And I thought, okay, so I asked him that question. I'm wondering if you have done any kind of similar study. You write in the article that you know that dementia may be looming. You may be a little bit concerned about what might happen in this decade. Are you?
Well, yes and no. As far as I can judge, and as far as my friends can judge, unless they're humoring me, I'm fairly intact at the moment. But the likelihood of strokes and dementias and mishaps of every sort and of death becomes greater and greater as one gets older. Although I want to qualify that, because I work at some old age homes, and I know a lot of feisty people in their 90s and their 100s who seem in better health than some people in their 70s. But in general, sort of things, possibly bad things, lie ahead.
Mm-hmm. You've only had, though, a scattering, you say, of medical and surgical problems. You've been extraordinarily blessed, really, haven't you?
Yeah, I've been very lucky, and I've just come back from my daily swim. I'm a little unsteady on land, but I'm very much at home in the water.
Are you really? Oh, I like that.
So I sort of totter to the pool with my stick, and then take off like a porpoise, and I really feel a completely different person. I look like a completely different person. It was similar with my father, who was a wonderful swimmer till he died at 94.
Oh.
But he was in a wheelchair past 90. That was in the days before knee replacements and things, which I've had. But we would wheel him to a pool and sort of tip him in, like tipping something off a wheelbarrow, and he'd be straight off like a porpoise.
Oh, I'm a swimmer as well. I understand what you're saying completely. I hope to swim forever. I'm wondering if you worry about dying. Do you worry about that? And do you worry about it? Do you think about it more as you get older?
I don't think I thought about it much till I was 75 or so, and then a number of things hit me almost simultaneously. One was a cancer in an eye and various orthopedic problems. So I no longer felt invulnerable, but I don't think of death very much. What I do think of is time is maybe more limited, and there's so many things I want to do.
Mm-hmm.
Starting with three books.
Three books?
Yes, I have three books in mind.
What are those?
One will be a sort of autobiography, but it'll take the form of sketches and pieces, and which won't be like Uncle Tungsten.
Mm-hmm.
One will be a book of essays about the nervous system and biology generally. One of them I've already written is about flowers and Darwin.
Hmm.
A third one, I think, will be some case histories of one sort or another.
Mm-hmm.
Of all sorts. I just wrote one about a man who developed hiccups terribly severely after an operation. And one thinks of hiccups as trivial, but it got worse and worse.
Oh.
And he thought he might die. We tried everything and it didn't work, but finally we were able to find a hypnotist, and he was hypnotized and told to stop hiccuping, and he did.
Oh!
So, after practicing for more than 50 years, I've got a lot of stories to tell.
Oh, do you ever? Probably more than most anybody who's walking on Earth right now. You also wrote in the article that you don't have a belief in, but you also, I found this interesting, didn't have a desire for post-mortem existence. You don't want to live past this life?
I don't know that I want to be an angel or a devil or a ghost. I sort of can't imagine any sort of existence except in this body, this now. I don't think I've ever had much metaphysical craving. I feel I'm an earthly creature, and I'm grateful for earthly life, and mm-hmm. that's it.
Hmm. We welcome phone calls if you would like to join our conversation. Oliver Sacks is our guest this hour, and we're spending a good portion of the hour talking about getting older. He wrote a really worth reading, we'll put it on our Facebook page if you didn't see it, opinion piece about what it's like to be turning 80, and he celebrated his 80th birthday last week. And the title of the article is "The Joy of Old Age, No Kidding," in which he discusses what you face physically. I love the fact that he swims every day. That's wonderful. That's the answer, right? Swim. You'll feel really good. And what his regrets may be and what his thoughts are about an afterlife and what it's really like to be the oldest person in the room. Here's our phone number. Join us if you would like. 800-486-8655 is our number. 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@wpr.org. And if you'd like, you can go to our Facebook page as well, where we'll post his piece and welcome your comments. And that's the Kathleen Dunn Show. His book, Hallucinations, was just released in paperback right before his 80th birthday, so we'll talk a little bit about that as well. I'm Kathleen Dunn. You are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Dr. Oliver Sacks is our guest, born in 1933 in London, England, which means that this is his year of his 80th birthday. He is known for all kinds of things, his collections of case histories from the far borderlands of neurological experience, The Man Who Mistook His Wife for a Hat, An Anthropologist on Mars, and many other books. He's investigated the world of deaf people and sign language in Seeing Voices. His latest book, just released in paperback, is Hallucinations, and we welcome phone calls for him. 800-486-8655. Is our number. Let's start our calls with Eugene in Viola. Hi, Eugene.
Oh, good afternoon, Kathleen.
Hi.
I hope this is relevant to the conversation, but I just turned 74 in January. A couple of years ago, I ran 100 yards, and I did it in 17 seconds. But I grew up right after World War II, from late spring until late fall. My lunch would come out of the garden. You would radish, potatoes, carrots, tomatoes, wash them off in a water tank, and go. And I walked a mile and a half to a country school, and all three of us boys grew up about the same, and all three of us are healthy little pigs today. we're very, very healthy as a result of our good diet. Okay, I'll be picking apples again this fall, and I'm painting a house down there in Gay's Mill. It's going to take about 25 gallons. I'm working off 20-foot ladders, and my health and my reflexes and everything are good. But I attribute it to two things. First of all, I get a little I get good exercise. Secondly, I stay on an excellent diet if I can.
Oliver Sacks?
Well, I think a good diet and plenty of exercise are strongly to be recommended, but also so are good genes, and one can't order those up. If someone's grandparents all live into their 90s, they have a good chance of doing so. But you can't alter your genes, whereas you can alter your life. And I more or less live on sardines myself. I love oily fish, and that's supposed to be good for one.
Yes. Thank you, Eugene, so much for your call. Let's go to Carol in Madison. Hi, Carol.
Hi. Hello, Dr. Sacks. It's nice to speak with you.
I missed that.
Yeah, she just said it was nice to speak with you. Go ahead, Carol.
I wanted to comment a little bit about my mother. She died about 5 years ago when she was 95, and her physical health had been really good up until she lived alone until she was 92. And I can recall when she was in her early 80s, she was still out mowing her lawn, and the little boy across the street watched this old lady mowing the hill in front of her house and thought he should go over and offer to do it for her. And she said, "Oh, I just don't think you're big enough." And she was about 5 feet tall. But interestingly, the last couple of years of her life, she had some dementia. It was Lewy body dementia. And one of the side effects or one of the symptoms of that is hallucinations. And while she didn't find her hallucinations very enjoyable a lot of the time, they were very interesting to my sisters and me. And she, from her chair in a care facility, she went to London a couple of times. And I just thought her stories were so amazing, the hallucinations. And so I'm wondering if there's anything in Dr. Sacks' book about those kinds of hallucinations.
Well, I describe all sorts of hallucinations. Some can be terrifying and some can be wonderful. I think a rather special category can be hallucinations of travel and of adventure. And I think these might be common sometimes in older people as they get immobilized, and what they can't do in reality they will start to do in fantasy or hallucination.
She said that her mother was terrified of them. You talk about how our cultures, Western cultures particularly, do regard hallucinations as a sign of madness, whereas other cultures say they are a privileged state of consciousness.
Well, there's a little bit of right and a lot of wrong in both of those. People are afraid to mention hallucinations if they get them, and people in general, and doctors for that matter, often regard them as a sign of dementia or madness or impending madness. The vast majority of hallucinations are fairly benign and have other causes. Although they're sort of pursued in a religious context by some cultures, in a quiet way they can have good effects. The hallucinations of bereavement, for example, and in which one may see or hear the loved person for many months after their death. And people, mourners, tend to like these hallucinations, and they seem to be part of the business of mourning. But there's so many sorts of hallucinations, I don't think any sort of definition covers them all.
You have dreams, we're talking about something different than hallucinations, but we were talking about death earlier. You dream often of your parents, don't you, and people who have gone before you. And are those pleasant dreams for you? Do you learn anything from them?
On the whole, they're pleasant, although I sometimes feel like crying when I wake up.
Oh.
Because then immediately one says, oh, that was 40 years ago or 70 years ago,
mm-hmm.
or whatever. I think everyone and everything which has been important to one stays in one's mind at some level and comes out in dreams. And that's very healthy. In general, I think dreams are healthy and necessary, unlike daydreams, which were a waste of time, I think.
That may be how I waste some of my time, because I do find myself daydreaming. Thanks, Carol, very much for your call. Let's go to Laurel in Baraboo. Hi, Laurel.
Hi. I just wanted to say thank you, Dr. Sachs, because I have been reading your book since I was 13 years old. I'm in my 40s now, and I just think that you are just the most intelligent and compassionate man. I love the tone that you describe your patients with, and I would also love to encourage everyone to read Uncle Tungsten, because it is an amazing memoir.
Oh, well, thank you, Laurel. Uncle Tungsten was fun to write, and I certainly hope it's fun to read.
I haven't read that. Can you tell us a little about it?
It's subtitled Memories of a Chemical Boyhood, and as a boy, I had a passion for chemistry, and I had a laboratory of my own. And in those days, in the 1940s, you could get anything you wanted. And I had all sorts of things which sometimes exploded or were poisonous.
Ooh.
But I just loved chemistry. I loved making crystals and all the colors. And I had an uncle who made tungsten filaments for incandescent bulbs, but we called him Uncle Tungsten, and he was a very important sort of mentor figure for me.
Mm-hmm.
I never liked school all that much, but I loved doing things for myself in the lab and the garden. I'm a hands-on sort of person. And anyhow, Uncle Tungsten is sort of tells my story up to the age of 15, and then it's discreetly stops.
Well, you write in the Times piece, and I thought, well, there aren't many people who can say this, that you have had dreams. Elements and birthdays have been intertwined since boyhood, and you had a dream about Mercury, element number 80. I can't imagine having a dream about that.
Oh, no. I have lots of dreams about elements and chemistry generally.
I know.
It's sort of deep inside me.
Right.
And now the birthday present I most appreciated has been a bottle of mercury. It's a little bottle, but it's quite heavy. It weighs 7 pounds.
Oh.
And it's a special bottle, because even if it's dropped, nothing will break or leak.
Uh-huh.
And I was also given a statue of Mercury. Mercury is the winged messenger of the gods.
Uh-huh.
And someone has given me a ticket for a virtual journey to Mercury and the planetarium. So I will try and live up to Mercury.
You did have quite a birthday party, didn't you? Thanks, Laurel, very much for your call. Our number, if you would like to join this conversation with Dr. Oliver Sachs, is 800-486-8655. He celebrated his 80th birthday last week, and he wrote a piece in the New York Times. We're putting it on our Facebook page so you can read what he wrote, his reflections on that big birthday. And his book, his latest book, he's written 12, Hallucinations, was released in paperback right before his birthday. Our number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org, and the Facebook page, if you'd like to leave a message there, please do, is the Kathleen Dunn Show. Tim in Appleton, our next caller. Hi, Tim.
Hello.
Hi.
Hello.
Hello.
Go right ahead, Tim.
You can hear me, right?
Yes.
Okay, I just wanted to share with a gentleman just a little bit ago, he, while talking about a spiritual afterlife, you know, he mentioned that he had very little interest in a ghostly realm or spiritual realm, and I just wanted to share a book that is entitled Heaven. It's by Randy Alcorn, and point out that heaven is very misunderstood, but the Bible makes it clear that it's you mentioned, sir, that you can't imagine existing in any other body but the one you have, and you will have that body in heaven. It'll be new, refreshed, brand new, just as the earth will be. So again, I don't want to push a religion or at you, but I would just suggest reading the book Heaven by Randy Alcorn.
Okay, well, I haven't read that book, but I have read a book with a similar title called Proof of Heaven, and it has a subtitle of A Neurosurgeon's Journey to the Afterlife.
Oh, right.
And this book has been on the bestseller list for a year, and it sold 2 million copies, and it obviously has a lot of appeal. The neurosurgeon had one of these so-called near-death experiences in which he felt himself translocated through a bright light into a wonderful realm, which he felt was heaven. This sort of experience is not uncommon, and it can convert people to a belief in heaven and afterlife. I would love such an experience myself if I could have it without being near death. I mean, sometimes so-called near-death experiences, you know, can occur in a seizure or even a migraine. I think sort of heaven one way and another is an idea which all of us have. I feel that Mozart's music comes from heaven, and you know, we often call things divine.
Mm-hmm.
Despite what the gentleman says, I really have no wish to be resurrected in the body, and I think when this body has done its fill on the earth, let it rest in peace.
Mm. And what is the appeal? Why is that book such a big bestseller? Why do
Well, because people want to believe in an afterlife and a happy afterlife, and he uses, and to my mind misuses, his credentials as a neurosurgeon. He says, "I know all about the brain," and he insists that this experience does not come from the brain, but has been infused into him somehow supernaturally.
Mm.
I mean, that is the good news which people want to hear.
Mm-hmm.
I would half like to believe it myself. I know the old thing, Lord, sort of help thou my unbelief, but I'm a stubborn unbeliever, mm-hmm, and always have been.
Thank you, Tim, for your call. Dr. Blanca from Madison. Hi.
Yes, Dr. Oliver Sacks, I'm so honored to be able to talk with you. I'm 87 years old. This is the age of the brain. And you talked a little bit about music and the songs of the universe. Take a man like Mozart. He had hardly time to write down all the music he heard in his brain. The question is then, what is consciousness? Was this Mozart, or was this the song of the universe? Thank you so very much to consider this.
Thank you.
I'm a little puzzled by that, but one of my birthday presents was 50 Schubert CDs, and Schubert had even less time than Mozart. And, you know, both of them reached such celestial heights. One wonders, you know, what they might have done had they lived longer.
Mm-hmm. Tell me more. You wrote about this, and I'm just wondering how you experienced this. This very much lived sense of history that you wouldn't have unless you were 80 years old. Can you tell me more about what that means for you? There is a lot of lived history now.
I was just 6 when World War II broke out, but I remember, say, some of the speeches of Winston Churchill and how these could energize a whole nation. I remember the the way in which people helped each other during air raids and the sort of comradeship when London was in deep trouble. Having conscious memories at least of say 70 to 75 years is not so much of a jump to 100. And somehow or other, it seems to me that I can imagine 100 more easily.
Mm-hmm.
But I think it's very difficult to imagine oneself older than one is. I mean, I wonder about the perspective of the last caller, that nice gentleman of 87.
Yes.
I think you probably need to have a centenarian on the show.
Okay, you know any?
I know quite a lot.
Okay. We'll probably go to you for a referral then.
Right.
That would be an interesting show to have several of them on the air.
Yeah.
Or to have just people of all different ages, right?
Yes.
Somebody who is 10, 20, 30, 40, 50?
Yeah. No, there used to be a wonderful NPR show about centenarians, and several were interviewed, and two of them fell in love with each other because of the interview and married.
Oh, did they really?
Yeah.
I love that story. Oh.
Yeah, no, the vital juices can still be flowing in 100s.
Right. Oh, we'll have to research that. Thanks for the call. Clyde is next in Hurley. Hi, Clyde.
Well, good afternoon, Kathleen. What a beautiful name was my ex, my late wife's name.
Thanks,
beautiful.
Clyde. Thank you.
And I understand the gentleman is originally from England. Tell him I beat him over here. We came, and the Randall family came over in 1635. And so welcome to the country. And anyway, I also have to say I'm 84, and I'm stretching for 85 in November. And I quit playing tennis at the age of 65 because I broke a couple of toes 10 years before that, and they got calcified. But I always say this, Oliver, uh-huh. Life is good.
certainly the opposite is true. One doesn't have any choice.
Right.
And I think living is good under almost any circumstances. I say almost because, you know, there's sort of some awful situations like intractable pain,
mm-hmm.
which can blot out the universe. And I think people should have the right to end their lives if life is not good anymore.
And when you've lived to be 80, your lived history includes, as you write, triumphs and tragedies, booms and busts, revolutions and wars, great achievements, and also deep ambiguities.
Yeah, ambiguities of every sort. One never knows, say, what technology may do. I don't know how it is in Wisconsin, but in New York City, 90% of the people are on cell phones or texting all the while, and it's like being in a street of zombies.
Mm-hmm.
You know, no one seems to be in touch with their immediate environment. And I think what seems to be the great virtue of digital technology is also a great danger.
Yeah, that's another thing that's virtually impossible to imagine where we'll be 20 years from now with all of that, isn't it? Who knows?
Yeah.
Thank you, Clyde. I'm glad life is good for you. Let's go next to Ed in Wautoma. Hi, Ed.
Yeah, hello. I've read all of your books, Mr. Sachs, and one book that interested me quite a bit was Musicophilia. I've been a musician since I've been about 4 or 5. You know, I'm over 55 now, and I do something that I call mental telepathicophilia. You know, I write songs constantly, record them with other musicians, but if I put a headset on and an MP3 player and I'm listening to it through the earphones, other people can hear it. And I sell at events like fairs, festivals, and so forth every single weekend. And so I get a chance to experiment to see, am I imagining this or is this really happening? And you know, I mean, people start dancing. People, I mean, I can just tell without me doing any slight body movements that they can hear this. And I've got the feeling that everybody couldn't do mental telepathy to some degree, but it's like some people have a mental block about it. And I thought it would be a great thing for somebody who know something about neurology like you do and has available, you know, like PET scan, CAT scan, transcranial magnetism and so forth to be able to see, you know, how the brain is working if and how that can happen, that I can do that. And I think in your book, Musicophilia, you mentioned that if you freeze a left lobe or frontal lobe, that people become very creative in the sense that they come up with a lot of ideas one right after another because it's like the left lobe isn't saying that's a bad idea while you're thinking it. I wonder if the same thing could apply to somebody that was paralyzed and couldn't do hand motions to speak, if they could somehow see what their neurotransmitters are firing to.
Okay. Oliver Sacks?
Yeah, you know, I'm a little deaf, and the gentleman was speaking rather too fast for me. I think one of the amazing things about music and listening to music is that you are given access to someone else's consciousness. To some extent, you may know what Mozart is like by listening to his music, and. And this is a sort of telepathy across the centuries. I've never been persuaded that telepathy in the ordinary sense exists, but there are now increasingly sort of forms of what are almost electronic telepathy. If, for example, people who are locked in and paralyzed and speechless may be able to move a cursor or move a robot by thinking, and electrodes may pick up impulses from the motor parts of the brain and directly, and those impulses in principle could be transmitted to another brain. So I think one might have a crude form of electronic telepathy. But I stress crude because I think only something like a movement has a very clear brain correlate, whereas I think a thought doesn't.
Can you?
But anyhow, I'm wandering off what I know about.
Yeah, but it was a good response to him. When you say you can sometimes tell what a person is like by listening to his or her music, I'm wondering, does that extend to other forms of communication? Can you tell what a person is like if you've read an extraordinarily good book or if you've listened to a drama or seen somebody deliver news? And the second part of the question is, can you be fooled?
Yeah. Well, I think all language and all art, reveals or as you intimate to some extent, conceals consciousness. And there's sort of paradoxes there. Interestingly, people who have aphasia, who have lost the use of language, are better at detecting lies than the non-aphasic people, because they don't get deceived by the words. And they are tremendously sensitive to tone of voice and expression and posture and all that. But I think, you know, on the one hand, we are all locked in our own skulls, and there isn't any direct communication, but there's so much indirect communication.
We welcome more phone calls. Oliver Sacks is our guest this hour, and we are wishing him a happy belated birthday, although from the sound of it, he had a terrific birthday party. Last week, he turned 80, and he wrote about this birthday in the New York Times. We're putting that on our Facebook page. It was last Sunday's. I still want to call it Week in Review. It's not called that anymore, but it's locked in my brain forever. It's the Sunday Review, right? That's where it was. And It's also the month when his book, Hallucinations, appeared in paperback. That's his latest book. He has written 12. Here's our phone number, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Email talk@wpr.org or leave messages on our Facebook page, The Kathleen Dunn Show. Oliver Sacks is professor of neurology at the NYU School of Medicine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Let's go to more phone calls for Oliver Sacks. And Jane in Merrill is our next caller for you. Hi, Jane.
Hi, Jane. I just wanted to call because I read the New York Times article that Oliver Sacks wrote. I'm 55, and I'm afraid of getting older. And that hopeful, wonderful article gave me such a new perspective, and I'm excited to get older. And I wanted to thank him for sharing his gift of thoughts in his writing and giving hope to one little old 55-year-old in Wisconsin.
Thank you, Jane.
Well, that is very nice to hear that, and I hope there are a lot of other people who will view aging more optimistically.
Were you ever afraid of getting older? Have you been afraid?
I don't know. I think I never sort of thought of it very much.
Okay.
I, which is why I'm suddenly, as it were, so surprised at finding I'm 80.
Mm-hmm.
You know, whereas the last time I paid attention, I was 30.
Isn't that the truth? Mary, thanks, Jane. Mary is next in Kenosha. Hi, Mary.
Hi. I hope you can hear me.
Oh, sure.
I have two experiences I want to pass on to him and see what he would say. And I have read at least one of his books, and I loved it. And every time I hear him on the radio, I love him. It's just so great to hear somebody who has his kind of expertise. Anyway, I knew my mother was dying. I'd been up to see her in northwestern Wisconsin. And after we got back that day, I was sleeping, and all of a sudden I was awake, and there was this 10-foot-tall angel escorting my mother down this little slope. I think it was to a river. And I looked at the clock and waited for my brother to call. And my brother, he knew we'd been driving a long way, so I knew he wouldn't call me right away. So at a decent hour, he called, and I says, "Hello, John, did Mother die at such and such a time?" He says, "Yes, to the minute. How did you know?" "You can't know. I haven't told you yet." Anyway, that's how I knew my mother had died, is because I saw her with this angel. And then I have a friend who's got a PhD in ancient civilizations and ancient spirituality. And she said, "Describe for me exactly what you saw," and I did. And she said, "Well, that image comes out of what we now call the Scandinavian countries." "So was she a Scandinavian?" I said, "Yes, her people were all Danish." So I thought that was reaffirming to me in a lot of ways.
What do you think, Dr. Sacks?
Well, I don't know what to think. There was a society called the Society for Psychical Research, formed in England and also in America in the 1870s, and which was especially formed to investigate these phenomena of visions of dying, phantasms of the dead, and so forth. I think they have to be regarded as hallucinations, but are the hallucinations which can tell the truth, which can convey information in a way otherwise impossible?
Hmm.
One can do no more than pose the question, and I'm sort of on the skeptical side, but then people multiply experiences, and one doesn't know what to think.
Hmm. Well, what about your personal experience? I know you've had experience, drug-induced hallucinations and others, auditory hallucinations. Do you feel that you experienced a kind of truth?
I have a scandalous chapter in my hallucination book about messing with drugs in the 1960s and having all sorts of hallucinations. I should say right away that this is not recommending drugs. Quite the opposite. I think I was very lucky to survive a series of follies.
Mm-hmm.
But some of the hallucinatory states had beauty, and some seemed to have meaning. On one occasion, I hallucinated a color, which I called indigo, but it was a color I'd never seen in my life and which I've never seen since. All I know was that this was the most beautiful color, and it seemed to me the color of heaven, which is very odd since I don't believe in
right.
heaven. but there you are. And there was another sort of hallucinatory state, or a visionary state at least, on drugs while I was reading a book about migraine, a book written in the 1860s, and I thought it the most wonderful book I'd ever read. I sort of imagined migraine shining like a star somewhere in the universe, and I felt one should write a book for the 1960s, and that I was the man.
Hmm.
And when the drug wore off, I still had that feeling, and I wrote the book, and I never took drugs again. So I think visionary states can have a lot of power for good or evil.
Right. Thank you, Mary, for your call. Harry is next in Madison. Hello, Harry.
Hello, Kathleen.
Hi.
Hello, Dr. Sachs.
Hello.
Could you try to answer this question? From your vantage point, with your experience and training, if life is finite, if death is final, what is the purpose of life?
I think it's up to you to find a purpose and make a purpose. I don't think there's some. And you are a free man, for better or worse, and one has the freedom to discover what has meaning. I don't think it's implanted in one, but life happens, and if you ask, and human beings are in the special position that they have to do more than eat and drink and copulate. And so I don't know that the life of an ant has any particular meaning, although an ant might protest at that. but it's up to us to make some meaning, which I think basically is to explore what we can do and do it, and to explore feeling and relationships with other people, and to make a good life.
Mm. Thank you, Harry, for the call. Not too many of our guests are asked that question, but I would imagine Dr. Sachs is asked that fairly often. Jim in Madison is next. Hello, Jim.
Hello there.
Hi.
Dr. Sachs.
Hello.
Thank you for speaking with me. I also am one of your fond readers. And as you have often done in your books, you get us involved in your personal life. Uncle Tungsten is a good example. And if I'm not too forward, I'd like to ask a question. I believe I read, maybe in hallucinations, that you also have face blindness. Do I remember that correctly?
Yes, I do have face blindness. It can be very, very embarrassing and difficult, and sometimes funny.
Your books where you mentioned that's your own issues as well. And I'm wondering, in future books, what other bombshell will come to us about your personal life that has become a part of your own research?
Well, we only have about 30 seconds left.
Okay.
So,
I don't know. You'll have to wait and see.
And he has three books coming out, so you'll have three chances relatively soon. Dr. Sachs, a great pleasure to speak with you. Thank you so much for your time and for all of your writing. Thanks.
Thank you very much.
Oliver Sachs, our guest this hour, his latest book, he has many of them, but this, right before he turned 80, his latest book, Hallucinations, was released in paperback, so it is available to you, and we thank him for being with us. We will put that column that he wrote last Sunday's New York Times. It's on turning 80, and it's good. It will prompt a lot of conversation, I'm sure, if you read it with friends or family. The Joy of Old Age, No kidding. And it will be on our Facebook page, The Kathleen Dunn Show. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning and KP Whaley for producing this hour. Thanks for all of your calls. Please be with us tomorrow from 1 until 3. And remember that there are lively and interesting conversations ahead.